Welcome to Two Bits, hosted by Mitch Sanders and Douglas Mudd, and produced by the American Numismatic Association. Tonight we'll be talking about numismatic literature and discussing a few of the ins and outs and also some of our favorite books.
Yeah, it's another of our periodic numismatic literature roundups, numismatic literature reviews. I don't think we have a firm title for it, but we did this in one of our earliest podcasts. And it's something we could talk about this probably every month. We could come up with a list of compelling numismatic books that would be informative and interesting to talk about. I don't think we will do it every month. There's a lot of things to talk about, but that's a testament to how much action there is in publishing, in numismatics, in the present day, and new works that are coming out, and also an abundance of existing works, classic works that are definitely still relevant, still really informative today.
That's right. I mean, I think we're in a golden age of numismatic printing, because over the last approximately 10 years, Whitman has really stepped forward to produce a large number of new titles and revolutionized the design and layout of many types of numismatic books as well. And it all fits in from our standpoint, certainly from mine. You want to buy the book before the coin. And my library is a testament to that, with several hundred books and other types of numismatic publications, such as catalogs and stuff.
Now, I may sometimes deviate from the typical numismatic advice to buy the book before the coin. My adaptation, it's more like buy the book before you buy too many of the coins. Like, usually it starts with a coin or maybe a small number, and then wanting to delve in and learn more in a more specialized way. Like, there might be something I'm pursuing that is written about in the Red Book, or in one of the volumes that you just mentioned, the Whitman series that Q. David Bowers has been putting out, now up to 25 volumes. But then, you know, to delve into something more specialized after that general approach. So I don't always live up to the maximum of buying the book before the coin, but I don't like to get too far without getting some kind of numismatic literature involved.
I agree. I've done the same thing, where I started with medals by purchasing one or two medals and then realizing I needed to learn more about them if I wanted to really get serious about them, and started to purchase books.
And now that, you know, that said, there have been times when I learn about a collecting area by encountering a work of numismatic literature. Like, you know, I know with Irish coins or ancient Greek coins, I wasn't necessarily looking in that area, but just kind of looking around at coin books and encountered these volumes that then led to an interest. So it's maybe more complicated than always buy the book before the coin, but they go together one way or another, whatever the exact ordering. And I think, you know, for you and for myself and for so many other collectors, collecting numismatic objects and then also acquiring books that are about those numismatic objects, those two activities go hand in hand. And as I think about my entire experience as a collector, that's really been the story, that the coins and the books, they go together in a reciprocal causality, where being interested in the objects leads to an interest in the books, and then the books themselves can inspire additional interests in those same subjects or other subjects.
Absolutely. I mean, I got into my primary collecting area by being introduced to them by the curator of the National Numismatic Collection, where I was working at the time. Mrs. Clayne Stefanelli actually was showing me the ancient coins, and we came across the Parthian coins, and I was fascinated. Mm-hmm. In part because I found them fascinating in and of themselves, but also because I had lived in the region, in Syria, as a boy. And also because when I discovered that they were inexpensive compared to any other Greek coinage, pretty much, you could buy most of them for $50 or less at that time. This is back in 91, 92. But what really started me was when Fred Shore came out with his brand new book in 93 of about Parthian coins, 10 Dragons Against Rome. And that basically gave me the push that I needed to actually start collecting them, because here was a great book with some history attached to it, plus a catalog. It made it very easy. And I think that's probably true for a lot of numismatic areas, especially the more esoteric ones that haven't been covered as well over the in the past. A new book comes out, and if it's well illustrated and compelling with its story, I think you find that most numismatic areas will get a bump in the number of collectors once they see a book that tells them how to start.
Yeah, it's a real inspiration to have information compiled and to be able to learn the story behind whatever the object is, and to see what they look like in detail, and to see an array of them, and maybe to have a catalog as well to indicate the scope of what a collection might look like. So yeah, I definitely agree that especially now that there's so many more opportunities for publishing and for information to be obtained. It just opens up more and more areas of collecting. And I'm also in preparing for our podcast for this episode, I was kind of reminiscing about some experiences that I've had with numismatic literature. And another reason why this is a golden age is that there are so many ways to find books and so many ways to learn about them, to learn if they exist, and then to locate them and to acquire them. Like I remember in the 1990s, there were books that I looked for years and could never find. And then around the turn of the century, you had all kinds of online booksellers, and that made things so much more straightforward. Now, of course, there is always something enjoyable about the search, but these particular searches were never successful. And I don't know when they would have been if I were just checking out numismatic literature dealers' lists or auctions or used bookstores, physical used bookstores. But now there are just so many more ways to learn about books and to find books. So it's not only what's out there, but the ability to actually know about it and acquire it that is so much more advanced than it ever has been.
Sure. I remember spending lots of time going to different used bookstores back before the internet really took over and killed a lot of the bookstores, but always hoping that they had a numismatic section and perhaps finding something really good and special. I remember finding several books that were fairly expensive for a bargain price at a bookstore that didn't specialize in numismatic items.
Right.
And then online you could find, Charlie Davis and various other booksellers that specialize in numismatic books, and a couple of them had regular auctions, and that was great. But yeah, there were certainly books that if they weren't actually in stock at the major places, you couldn't find them at all. So things like bookfinder.com became a major revelation and a major source for finding all sorts of numismatic books from anywhere in the world.
Oh yeah, it was the whole idea of buying books online was such a revelation when it first happened. I remember I looked the volume I was looking for that stands out was Numismatic Art in America by Cornelius Vermeule, which was a classic, and I'd seen it from my university library, but then I was not at the university anymore, and I tried to find a copy. It was for years, and then when online bookselling became a possibility, I found one. It wasn't that difficult, and I ordered it and I had it. And then, like maybe 6 months later, I was at a used bookstore in Indiana and I saw another copy of Numismatic Art in America, the first time I'd ever seen one for sale at an actual bookstore. And I went ahead and bought it. I already had one, but I went ahead and bought that one that I found. I couldn't resist. It was just such a capstone to that search. So now that's a classic book, and it's been republished by Whitman Publishing, so now it's even easier to find. But I just, I always think of that book as the one, it was like my white whale. I could never locate it. And then I did. And then I finally found one, you know, in the wild, as they say. And I just couldn't resist buying it again. But that's the kind of book. There are a few books like that were, it's just, I don't know, it's worth it to have multiple copies, have one in every room of the house. It's that kind of a book.
Yeah, there was a book by Gerald Hoberman on numismatic photography, which is an absolutely stunning book, large format, and has beautiful, beautiful photos. And he talks about how to take these photos. Plus, he adds history and beautiful line drawings of parts of the inscriptions and parts of the coins themselves. So it took me a while to find that, but I found it in some hole-in-the-wall used bookstore and managed to get it for a price that was great for me at the time. And after that, I was lucky enough to find out he had done another book on stamps on coins, which is a nice little slim volume, but it has, again, absolutely stunning pictures using Israeli stamps that have used coin themes on them. So quite a neat book also.
Yeah. The Hoberman book, The Art of Coins and Their Photography, that's a favorite of mine too. And it was a similar story. I saw it in my university library, looked around for a while, could never find it, finally did find it online. And then again, I saw one in a bookstore. This actually was not that long ago, maybe within the past couple of years. I saw one in a bookstore and I couldn't resist having another copy. I guess this is kind of a pattern. I don't actually have two copies of every book that I enjoy, but some of these really special ones, I just can't resist having another one, one for each room, or, you know, one day I'll encounter someone else who's interested and give it away to that person. But yeah, these quests, they're easier to fulfill. And that's such a nice element of the hobby these days.
Of course, you could be like myself, where I look for books for, sometimes I'm looking for them for years, and occasionally I'll come across a book in a bookstore and I'm not sure if I have the book or not. And so I'll end up with two copies that way.
Yeah, right.
I don't want to risk not getting it.
Can't take a chance. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And I do that even when I know I have it. But if I didn't know I had it, yeah, I would be even more likely to. So yeah, and there, maybe that would be another interesting theme for a podcast one day, which would be books that we have multiple copies of for one reason or another, that are too compelling to turn away. But for this podcast today, it's more miscellaneous in that we've each thought of a few books that we really like for one reason or another, and for different reasons. And to present those books and explain a bit about them and talk a bit about them. And I don't know what's on your list, and you don't know what's on my list. Maybe there are some books on both of our lists. I don't know. We'll see. So
yeah,
we have a few each, and with perhaps some duplication. Although there's so much out there, I expect probably not. So just to talk about the books and share some thoughts and see where it leads.
Absolutely.
All right. So can I kick us off?
Yes.
Okay. The first book, this is the reason why I wanted to go first. My first book on my list, familiar to you because it is your book, All the Money in the World, The Art and History of Paper Money and Coins from Antiquity to the 21st Century by Douglas Mudd. This book has been on my recommended list since I first saw it. I remember being in my local Barnes & Noble, and the book came out in 2006, so it must have been 2006, or if it was late 2006, maybe 2007. I remember seeing it on an end cap at Barnes & Noble, and I bought it immediately, of course, because it's a book that does what I really appreciate in a numismatic reference, is that it explains the background of the numismatic objects that are being presented. In the context of a broad overview, of money and its role in society. In looking at it in detail again for today, I know you described the theme of the book is money as a means of communication through art. And that is such a compelling subject to me and to so many others. And that's why I, you know, for the past 15 years, this book has been on my recommended list. And in my column in the Numismatist, every now and then I write about books that I recommend. And this has been on that list probably three times that I've done such lists. And it's got numerous and really beautifully done images of all kinds of money from around the world. I didn't count. It looked like it was maybe predominantly paper money in terms of its orientation, just the theme of the book and the description, and then just looking at the images, it seemed somewhat more paper money, but you know, maybe like 60-40, and coins are still really abundantly represented, and it's all range of items, right? Like there's an image of a United States $100,000 bill, which is uncollectible, and there's an image of a state quarter from Kansas. So you know, the entire range, but it's you know, the subject of money of the world, like the title is not meant to be taken literally. No volume can present all the money of the world, but it is an overview of all the money of the world, especially in recent centuries, but also going back to ancient times with the background of the coinage. It's a great overview with many, many examples of money as a means of communication through art. And I think that's a terrific subject for a book. And that's why it's always close at hand for me. And it's why it's the first book that I'm mentioning here in this podcast today. I guess my one question for you is there going to be a sequel, or is there another one in mind? Because it's such a great subject, and this book is copyright 2006, right? So 15 years.
Yeah, hopefully there will be more books along those lines. I did produce a book with an e-publisher about 2 years later on gold coins, and it basically, I think it was 50 gold coins, and I did a page on each one with a photograph to start them, not with any pricing, but basically they were selected for their historical importance. So things like the Athenian gold stater from 404 BC, the emergency money, and things of that sort. But I'm honored and touched that you find my book so compelling, because it was really a labor of love, and it had an interesting background to how it got published, because I happened to be answering the phone one time at the Smithsonian, and a publisher named Les Krantz was looking for somebody that could help him with writing a book about the history of money. Particularly, he was more interested in paper money, but as we started going into it, I said, I can help you out. I'd love to write the book. And we talked about details, and I started photographing and preparing for the book. One of the things that's interesting is that 99% of the images in the book are images that I took. I actually photographed almost everything in the book, except for illustrations. And the upshot was that I worked on it for about a year and a half. And in the meantime, Mr. Krantz was trying to find a way to work with Smithsonian Books, and he was unsuccessful. And he basically gave up, and we lost touch with each other. And soon after that, within a few months, I moved to Colorado Springs to take the job as curator at the Money Museum. About a year and a half, a year later or so, I got a request. Somebody was sending out emails asking about anyone who could provide images for a book that they were planning. And I recognized the way the questions were set up. And then I realized, wait a minute, the guy he mentions in here is Mr. Krantz. And so I contacted them and I talked to Les, and he said, hey, are you still interested in writing the book? And I said, sure, I've got 75% of the images and half the book written. I'm fine with it. So a year of intense writing and back and forth, and the book was done, and he had to find a publisher. What was really strange and ironic was that going all over the world, going to the Frankfurt book show and other major shows like that, he finally came around to the Smithsonian, because HarperCollins had bought the Smithsonian book rights. Basically, Smithsonian Books was not successful on its own, run by the Smithsonian. So they leased it to HarperCollins, and HarperCollins picked up the book. And so it made a long circle over a period of about 4.5 years, and ended up becoming a Smithsonian publication.
I didn't know. Well, I knew a little bit of that backstory from what you described in the book with Les Krantz, and you mentioned that he had been one of the authors of a book called The Art of the Market.
Yes.
Which was about stock certificates. And that's a book that I have multiple copies of that too. That's been a favorite, because it's not exactly numismatic, but it's you know, very much an affiliated field.
It's beautifully illustrated, for sure.
Yes, and you're dealing, you know, the same production, the same companies that made banknotes, they made stock certificates, American Banknote Company and others, and the vignettes and other artistry, they're really beautiful, and this laid it out really well. And so then, you know, upon seeing that connection, it made a lot of sense that your book would be, you know, in the same spirit as that book. So that was an interesting part of the story that I had known about, and then hearing the search for a publisher and the elements of the authoring experience, that's very interesting as well. And I, as I'm thinking about the book and as we're talking about it, one of the main virtues of the book is that it compiles this information in one place, right? Like if you looked at 75 different books about different numismatic collectibles, you would find, you know, somewhere in those books, the kind of information about art and using numismatic imagery to convey a message. But that would be kind of only part of a story of whatever the subject was. But with your book, I think what makes it special is that it's all about stories like that. Like that, you know, on every page, there's a story about that kind of connection between art and communication and numismatics. So that's, again, more reason why it's been such a strong recommendation for me for so long, and why it was the first item on my list here today.
Yeah, it really does reflect how I believe coins should be approached. It's how I look at them. It's the stories behind them that are really important to me. And so it was wonderful to be able to write about them. And then, you know, I photographed them. But the design team that Les Krantz had was just amazing. They did a wonderful job of working on that. And we got to go back and forth on the proofs and everything else. So it was a great experience from my standpoint. I'd worked on several other books in the past. Like Mrs. Stefanelli had produced a book on Roman Republican coinage. And somehow I ended up being the designer and the layout person and the translator. So it turned out to be fairly successful for a book that was self-published. But
yeah, it was fun. I have that one. I have that one on my shelf too. And then just to wrap up this discussion of this volume, there's still plenty of coins and currency out there that were not covered in the existing volume, so there's plenty of scope for a sequel. I'm just saying, if you're looking for thoughts and ideas and support and encouragement, I definitely vote in favor of continuing the discussion. So
Well, that's
in
that's
book what, form. I mean, we talk, you know, that's a lot of what we talk about in this podcast is that same theme. So, but to have it in book form is also quite nice.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that when I retire, I will start doing this. This is one reason why I've built up the library I have, so I can actually sit at home and do all the research and use the internet. But we'll see. I hope to do so.
Okay, I won't press you for any promises. Just putting it out there. All right. So you have a selection.
Yes, I went in basically the direction of books that I think are important, that I enjoyed, but also that are great beginners volumes. So one, I think I came fairly late to, maybe 15 years ago, was Eric P. Newman's The Early Paper Money of America, which I find to be just a wonderful book. It's about American colonial currency. And he really set a very high bar. It's in its fifth edition now, I believe. And the book is just a wonderful resource, not only for the fact that it covers pretty much every note, every circulating piece of paper that was issued in the colonial period, but also because of the stories it tells about how they were issued, the at times scandalous, but also at times ingenious ways that our colonial forebears were, they were forced to use a lot of different methods to make this money work. And they were quite good at it, because overall our colonial paper money experiments worked out pretty well. There were disasters, but by and large, it was quite successful up until the Revolutionary War. And the Revolution created circumstances beyond their control, which almost foredoomed the notes of that time to being unsuccessful. But it's a wonderful book. It's got a huge number of notes illustrated, all beautifully illustrated in color. Well, not all in color, but mostly in color. Some of them are pointless to do in color. Plus, just the vast amount of detailed information where possible. The research that went into this was spectacular, because you've got, in many cases, estimates of how many notes were issued, plus the variations, descriptions of the signers, some information about the signers of these notes in some cases, not in all of them, because it's virtually impossible. But it's a wonderful book. And if anybody's ever contemplating collecting U.S. colonial notes, it's a definite must have.
That's a great choice. I have that book too. I have not had it for very long. A few years, maybe something inspired me to investigate it. And I was able to find a copy, or something inspired me to pursue early American currency, and I got a copy, and it's a large format book. It's 9x12 or so, and it's almost 2 inches thick. I mean, it's quite voluminous. This was actually for me an instance of buying the book before the coin, or in this case, before the note. I had the book before I bought any colonial currency, and in fact I still have only one piece of early American currency, but there's like you said, there's such a wealth of information. It's a catalog, but also the introductory essays in general, and then on a colony or state by state basis, it really tells the story of this really compelling collectible, right? Like, I feel I've got so many cool things in my collection, but when I hold a piece of continental currency, like, that's a historical connection that is pretty rarefied, to have something, from the Revolutionary War that was part of people's experiences and part of the whole experience of the country. So that's a book that has earned the many accolades it's received.
Sure, and professionally, I use it on a regular basis, because there's so much information there that I could base museum columns or exhibits on, that it's pretty much essential, because there are other books that are out there, but none of them cover the whole time frame and types of notes the way this does. So it's an absolute must for a starting point for this period. And yeah. It has enough detailed information, so it's not just a starting point, it's also a fully rounded reference.
Yeah, that's definitely a great one. All right, should I give you my next volume?
Yes, I think we're ready for that.
Okay, the next volume on my list of favorites for this episode, there's a lot of great books out there, of course, but the ones I want to highlight at this time, the next one is pretty new. I think it just came out 2019, In God We Trust by Bill Bearley, published by Whitman Publishing. It's not part of their Bowers series, which is covering pretty much all of American numismatics. This is a standalone volume, and its subtitle is The American Civil War, Money, Banking, and Religion. It covers a variety of topics, but all through the lens of one particular idea, in this case, the idea being the core idea of the book being the motto, In God We Trust. Probably what most collectors know, and what I knew before reading the book, was pretty concise about the motto itself. I knew that it first appeared on American coins in 1864 on the 2-cent piece. I knew that now it's on all coins and all paper money issued by the United States. I knew that there had been a previous idea of the motto, which was, instead of In God We Trust, it was God Our Trust, on a bunch of patterns, and then ended up being used, the motto that ended up being used was In God We Trust. And I knew that in 1907, there was a controversy involving Theodore Roosevelt and the St. Gaudens coinage and the omission of In God We Trust. And another controversy involving presidential dollars, where the motto was on the edge.
Right. People couldn't find it.
Right. It seemed to be godless. It was actually there. It then ended up moving to the obverse. But in this book, it's 335 pages, that was just so illuminating about so many different things, about the motto, yes, and how it came to be, and various legislation and experiments, and the controversies I mentioned, and some others as well, about the motto, but also then using that as a framework to include all kinds of other really interesting elements, because the motto had its origin in the Civil War, and the Civil War was a period of such chaos in American money. So the book gets into that period in all of its detail, from the issue of paper money, the disappearance of gold and silver, the challenges with small change, the various experiments that were tried to cope with this that didn't always work, like using stamps as money or encased postage stamps, and then small denomination bills, and then finally new coins like the 2-cent piece, 3-cent piece, 5-cent piece. So the idea of the motto, In God We Trust, is it has an intrinsically interesting story, and then it's connected to so many other interesting stories, and that's what Bearley does, is he tells those stories, the book is really beautifully illustrated. It's all extremely well described. He also gives a lot of biographical details about the people involved, like James Pollock, director of the Mint, Salmon Chase, Secretary of the Treasury, his daughter, Kate Chase, who led a pretty interesting life that I had no awareness of until reading this book, Joseph Wharton, who did many things in American history, but for this part of the story, it's because he was the owner of a nickel mine, and the inability to get nickel was an important part of the American coinage story. So there's just so much that's so interesting in this book that I highly recommend it. Really to anyone with any interest in American numismatics, it touches on so many different elements that it makes for such a compelling story.
Yeah, it's interesting because I only became aware of the book a few months ago. We actually have it in our bookshop at the museum. Oh. And I think based on this recommendation, I'll probably pick it up. It's a story that I'm also very interested in, because having done an exhibit on the Civil War, we covered that theme, and I did some research on it because I wasn't that familiar with it back when the exhibit came up. It was in 2007 or 8 or something, and it was very interesting to me because, as you said, in God We Trust was not the only choice. You know, God Our Trust, and then God With Us. I always say Gott mit uns because I'm familiar with the German Lutheran version of the motto, and all three of them were up for consideration. But what was always interesting to me was how that motto also is an indicator in the change of the attitude of the country, because when the founding fathers originally wrote the Constitution and they started working on the coinage, they deliberately chose not to use any reference to God or anything else, because they were trying to separate church and state. And it's an indication of just how desperate things had gotten in 1863 when these discussions were going on, where basically three church leaders came up to Lincoln and proposed this idea to him on the basis of, well, there's no better time. We're on the brink of perhaps losing the Union, losing the war, and perhaps it'd be a good idea to bring God on our side. And one way to do that would be to bring this motto in, because it wasn't a case that the country wasn't religious. It was deeply religious, but the founding fathers had felt that politically speaking, it was a good idea to keep church and state separate. So it's very interesting that came about, and then it took another 50, 60 years before the idea took hold permanently, and not until the 1950s did the paper money begin to show it. And yet, as a curator, as somebody who works in museums, I'm always asked about that kind of thing. Because, for example, when the Godless Dollars came out and people didn't understand that the In God We Trust had been moved to the edge, we had people coming in or calling and they were outraged about this and how un-American it was and everything else. And it was sort of interesting. In most cases, there's no way I was going to tell them the history behind it, because that would have caused more outrage probably. But there's very much an interesting story there. And part of it is just how close to the brink we were to losing the Civil War, and how this was part of the measures of one group to counteract that. How do we get reinforcements?
And I didn't know this until reading the book, but part of the motivation for the adoption of the motto on coinage was that as you said, the U.S. Constitution does not mention God, but the Confederate Constitution does in the preamble. Mm-hmm. And so this contrast, I mean, there were many, many causes for this, but that was one fact that was mentioned in the book and contemporary to when this was happening, that there was this difference. In God We Trust was a result of this initiative. And it was also interesting, the book will explain it in much more detail than I can now, but the original legislation for the 2 cent piece did not specify that In God We Trust should be on the 2 cent piece. It made it possible to be on the 2 cent piece. So the legal status of the motto went from possible to then more possible on more coins, because it wasn't necessarily obvious that it could be added to all other coins, but legislation in 1865 said that it could. And then, gradually it transitioned from being a possibility to now, since the 1950s, now it's been a requirement on all coins, but it's a requirement that it appear somewhere on all coins. And as numismatists will tell you, coins have three sides. And the first couple of years of presidential dollars, it was on the edge, but then it was relocated to the obverse. And I was on the Citizens Coinage Advisory Committee at the time, and so we saw the design proposals for placing it on the obverse. There's still some edge lettering remained, but In God We Trust was now more prominently featured on the obverse. It was always ironic because the purpose of the edge lettering was to free up the obverse and reverse for artistic purposes.
Right.
There are a number of things that are required on American coins, E Pluribus Unum, the date, In God We Trust, among other things, but some of them being moved to the edge would provide more of a canvas, as they say, for the art on the obverse and reverse. But I think the edge lettering was like almost entirely problematic, first from a production perspective. Sometimes it was missing. And then In God We Trust, as we've talked about, but even something like having the date on the edge, which, you know, I can see that moving the date to the end would free up some room for artistry. But then a lot of people's reaction was that without a prominent date, it looks more like a token than a coin. And so, you know, it was the motive made a lot of sense to put things on the edge, but in practice, it seemed like it caused all kinds of trouble that was unanticipated. And the issue of In God We Trust, that was one piece of it that was then modified in response, but that was just one of the examples. And you know, the book gets into that, gets into the quote, godless presidential dollars, among other things that have happened in recent decades, with legal challenges to the motto. So it's just really, it's really a compelling story. Like, it's a great idea, piece of research, and really well presented. And it combines the story of the motto with the economic story of the Civil War, with the story of the personalities involved, with the numismatic story of the coins that were being issued. And it's just great to have all those pieces in one place.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to pick it up at this point, because I'd like to see some more of that story.
All right. Very cool. My mission's been fulfilled if I've encouraged you to pick it up and to read it. So that's great.
Thank you for listening to our Numismatic Literature Roundup. We finished the first half, and we will continue with the second half in our next podcast.